This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Denver poet Diana Coy Nguyen has a family haunted by bees. It's easier for the family to speak about the bees than it is to speak about her brother's suicide. But in her new book of poems, Ghost Of, Diana is talking. She joined me last week to discuss her work. I asked her to begin by reading the title poem.
I'll give a note, I guess, before I read it. There's a pun in there that the only person who would get are people who know my family. But my father's name is Sung, which is spelled S-O-N, like sun. So there's that pun.
Yeah, I did wonder about that. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Ghost of. One. One evening, a man and a woman, parents to two daughters, watch Oliver Twist, 1948 version, go to sleep and in the morning name their only son, Oliver. The family rejoices, even though they are industrious refugees who previously celebrated nothing, and for several years buy him gifts, feed him sugar. The eldest daughter resembles her brother until she wakes up one morning from a dream in which he lay in ermine, holding tightly to a scepter. Soon after, her hips widen. One lone hair grows in her armpit. Sometimes the daughter feels like a son. Sometimes the son feels like a shadow. "You can't draw inside the body," he says to his first grade teacher. "So why try to draw what's inside the body at all?" Two. If one has no brother, then one used to have a brother. There is, you see, no shortage of gain and loss. Let's admit without embellishment what we do with each other. When the daughter begins to walk, it is apparent she ambles pigeon-toed. A doctor tells her alarmed parents that no surgery is needed, just some roller skating. Each day, after work, the father helps his daughter stay upright on her skates. If you have a father, then you also have a son. A child has difficulty weaning from nursing bottle to glass of milk. Concise in her expression of impatience, the mother pours a gallon of milk over the girl's head. A tiger came across a donkey, and having never seen a donkey before, mistook it for a god. After everyone has gone to bed, an eldest child hoists her younger brother over her shoulders and then a sheet over his shoulders, and they sway as one into the middle sister's room. Who is weak and who is weaker, and what does relativity have to do with it? Three. Let me tell you a story about refugees. A mother and her dead son sit in the back seat of his car. It's intact, in their garage, and he is buckled in. She brushes the hair behind his ear. This is the old country, and this is the new country, and the air in the car is the checkpoint between them. Let me tell you a story about seatbelts. While driving her children to the local pool, a mother enumerates to her children their failures. There was a mother, she says, who put her children in a car, sewing their seatbelts so they couldn't unbuckle them, who drove them off a seaside cliff. A boy on a unicycle goes round and round a lighthouse, dodging tourists, ridicule, and awe. He doesn't go up. He doesn't fall down. "Son," says the mother, meaning child and not her husband. "Son," says the father, whose name is Sung. "Sister," says the son, lying in a coffin. "To hell with family," says the rest of the family. Four. A brother is a brother when he has at least one sibling. The brother believes he is not a brother, but one in name only. When the brother meets a couple his parents' age, he takes the time to tell them he's an only child and an orphan. The three of them agree that one must not be without family, that there must be at least two in a family, and that three is even better. They embrace, and the couple encourages the brother waiting for the other shoe to drop. Whose shoe? His or the couple's? Five pairs of shoes dangle from the pole of a traffic light. Over time, Birds make a nest in each hollow, each separate space. 5. Your hat is Mexican? Asks a sailor in Côte d'Azur. No, it's Moroccan. Are you from Japan? Asks a Moroccan shopkeeper in Marseille. No, I'm American. Is belonging and fulfillment possible without family? No. Is it possible with family? No. You cannot connect if you keep answering no. You cannot keep your brother alive if you keep your mouth shut. You cannot keep your brother alive. At camp, some counselors take the kids on an excursion into the woods, leading them in a game of hide and seek. One boy, a deaf child who was also going blind, hid so well that they couldn't find him, and he didn't find his way back. He had done everything right. Nabokov says, "The lost glove is happy." Is the lost brother happy? 6. A man lies in an open grave after a body is taken out of it. This practice is said to lengthen life expectancy. The brother imagines his bed is a nest in which his body is removed. There's a story about a man galloping by another man who asks, "Where are you going?" "Ask my hearse," says the man. "I was never lost in the jungle," says a father, "just looking for a way out."
Diana Coyne Wynn, her book is Ghost Of, her debut collection of poetry. I could ask about so many parts of that, so many lines I jotted down. Just to pick one, Nabokov says, "The lost glove is happy. Is the lost brother happy?" What went into that?
I think my hope is that he is no longer suffering in the way that he was when he was alive, which is logically how I understand his decision to end his life. Because if he was still unhappy, that's even worse, right? Then we're all suffering and he's still suffering. And I don't want to choose to think of it that way. I like to think about his death as an end to the negative, unpleasant feelings that he was experiencing. I think I can only think about it or talk about it in questions. I have so many questions for him. And maybe that one, I mean, that one isn't directed at him, like, are you happy? But to think about the lost glove, like, what is the life of that lost glove? Or what is the life of the lost brother if there is a life after life?
And your parents use that word lost.
Yes. In Vietnamese, the word for death is muk, which means lost. Like, same thing, like, oh, I lost my shoe. But it's also like your brother is, you know, has been lost, as if some unknown force has taken him from us. There's no agency, right? Like there's no a noun that does the action of doing that, like, yeah, removal.
There's no actor.
Yeah, that's right. There's no actor, although I know who the actor was. We all do, but we don't talk about that hand in that lost state, the lostness.
And that hand, the hand of Diana's brother, that hand created absences even before his death. In part, that's what pushed her to write the book that she has.
So 2 years before he committed suicide, in the middle of the night, because my brother lived at home and he never really left home. So this is, I guess, when he was 22. In the middle of the night, he went through the hallways in the house where all the family portraits hang. And he slowly removed the pictures with an X-Acto knife and he sliced himself out. Because you can see the cuts, the really careful cuts, which is different from when scissors are used.
These are in the book.
Yes, these are in the book. I've distorted them a little bit. And they're also reproductions of a scan. But I did the kind of ghosting image with these images. But then he put the pictures back in their frames and let them hang. So it was a very quiet violence, you know? Like, and so when my parents woke up and they walked through the hallways, I don't know if they saw it immediately or, I mean, but they realized it that day and they called me very alarmed. And I think it's not uncommon for those who have suicidal ideation to do physical acts, you know, like this, to remove themselves. I've heard now many accounts of friends whose father, you know, before they committed suicide, they did this. But what I think is interesting in the case of my brother and my family was these pictures continued to hang. My parents didn't touch them. And so when I came home, I'd have to walk through and see them. And this is while he's still alive, and nobody's really speaking to him, and he's living in that house. So we are all quite estranged, but it was also a household of silences in many ways about the past, about what was going on between us. My own relationship with my parents was pretty wrought at that point, too. And then he killed himself. And the pictures still continued to hang, and it was really hard for me to look at those photographs. And I thought, let's just face it head on. And at this point, it was 2 years, almost 2 years. I was approaching the anniversary of his death. So I had my sister scan the photos and send them to me. And I just sat there in the middle of the night, just staring at them, right? Like staring at that space where he would be and starting to think about him actively. And what would I say to him? And I didn't want the artifacts to have this awful totemic power. So I started just as an exercise. I'm just going to fill in the space. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not trying to re-represent him, but as a way to bridge this gap now that is, you know, between the worlds. I don't know where he is, like spiritually, if anything, because I don't really have any religious affiliation. And it like really opened up all of the feelings that I didn't know that I had or how to feel. Like it just allowed for things to come out. And that really became the impetus for the book, to begin to think about grief, how different species, humans, how we process grief and death practices and funeral practices, but also looking at how did this happen?
How did this happen? That is a question a lot of families ask themselves after they lose someone to suicide. I asked poet Diana Coy Wynn how her family has tried to answer that question.
This is something my mother says. She's very particular. I would argue, and I'm not a licensed or trained professional, but I would argue that she has various forms of OCD, right? Like if she needed something to be clean, even if it was 4 a.m. in the morning on a Tuesday, like we all had to do it, you know, and we'd do it for hours until it was right because she really couldn't like sleep or rest, and it affected all of us. And my mother likes to say, your brother has what I have, but worse. And so there's a story I tell that is really hard. I think, and actually not hard in the sense that I've realized I have all this empathy for my mother in many ways that I didn't have before. She does say that my brother was depressed, but not in the clinical sense. And I remember, I would say maybe it's about a few years ago. So after his death, she said, it's because we didn't listen to him. We didn't believe him. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, you know, when he was alive, he used to complain to us very briefly, you know, like he would report as if to a landlord, you know, that he couldn't sleep because there were bees in the walls. And my mother, my father both were like, we don't hear anything. You know, you're just making this up. So like, just chill out.
Go to sleep.
Yeah, go to sleep. And so this is simultaneous to this happening. The few times that I would return to the house, I would see a dead bee on the windowsill in our shared bathroom. My brother and I shared bathroom. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I just like, you know, throw in the trash. And this is before we realized that the colonies are dying. And then the next morning, there'd be another one. But the dead bee was still in the trash can. So it's just a new one. I didn't know where it was merged. There was no hole in the screens. I didn't think much about it. And my mother said that after he died, when they were cleaning up, like in the attic, they found like all of these hundreds of dead bees. There was like a hive up there. And she said, we didn't believe him and he couldn't sleep because he heard these bees and we never did anything about the bees. And he, because he couldn't sleep, he was depressed. And because he was depressed, he had to end that sound that he could, that was keeping him awake. And I say to my mother, I'm like, that's not your fault. You know, you didn't know. I also saw the bees. I didn't know either. And so the bees become this motif too, especially because they are dying off. And I think about not being believed, right? Like, and the various tensions that happen between parent and child. And my mother's like search to understand, why did he do this? Because she doesn't understand.
Again, we're talking with poet Diana Coy Wynn. talking about the search to understand, it can be hard to know what we understand about someone, especially after they're gone. A lot of things they found out about after her brother's death just underscored how little they knew about him.
We knew he had a job, but we didn't know what he did. And my parents only met the employers. They were Taiwanese. They are a Taiwanese couple living in Torrance, so in Southern California. And they didn't know he had died. And they also didn't know he had a family. So he worked, and he was like, my mother is so proud. She says, your brother was an excellent employee. Like, they promoted him. He did really well. That's how he had all this money. We didn't know how he had money. But he had told this couple that he was an orphan. And even though he was, you know, living at home, he didn't have a family. And so this couple essentially kind of took him in because they're like, oh, well, you need to have a family. And it's heartbreaking, but also I feel glad for my brother that he had people in that way, and sad that it wasn't us. And for whatever reason, he rejected us. And I find myself increasingly wanting to understand just who he was, because we didn't have access to talk to him. So I'm interested about that.
Diana was the oldest child. She has a middle sister, and her brother was the youngest. Growing up, she says she always knew her parents wanted a boy.
I don't think they feel that way anymore, necessarily. You know, now they're just like, you should have a child. I think in a way, because I think they're looking to start over, you know? There's this, I think this is really touching. My mother says to me now, it's time. You need to have a child. Because you're the only one, because your sister's not going to do it. You know, like, she's not interested in dating, so it's got to be you. And I was like, that's not on me. I could say no. You know, I don't have to. They're like, but you need to. And she says, I've been reading parenting books. And I said, what? And she said, well, I never read parenting books before I had children. And, you know, there was a period when I had time. So, and also after your brother, you know, is lost, I just was like, I wanted to be ready. So I've been reading parenting books, and now I realize I did everything wrong. And that, I feel such sympathy for her. I mean, I had a lot of anger as a child. Like, no, like, you're not treating us right, or, you know, et cetera. And also, I have lost such tenderness for her now, for her to realize, like, where she says, I wasn't tender as a mother, and I should have been more tender, you know, and I should have read these books. I didn't know. I just did what, you know, how I was raised in my country, and we're not in my country anymore, you know, and you guys aren't me. And so she has these regrets, although she doesn't verbalize them as regrets. And I see that she wants to try again, you know, because she says, like, I failed as a mother because I have lost a child. And she takes that really seriously, you know, and she's like, I failed. And I do think that she does want they want a kind of redemption, but I don't think it's more redemption. I think it's more, they just want life. You know, they want life.
Some poems in Diana Coy Wynn's book are in the shape of the place where her brother's life was removed from those family pictures. Remember, we talked about her late brother Oliver cutting himself out of family pictures, and I wanted to know more about the shape of those poems. Your poems are visually, physically shaped by these cutouts, these photos from where your brother is missing. So the poems are in the space, they're in him, and they're around him. Yeah. How did that happen?
Yeah, it was a way to reach him, literally, like, for the words to enter the void, the white space, which is also his body, which is no longer there, right? The body that he removed before he actually removed himself. And then, but that felt also like really morbid to do that. So I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to do that, I also want to be the words to also be like the family, like to have the words also be like the space around him, right? As like the support system, the environment. So to think about foreground and background in that way, and that made sense to me because it didn't feel right just to only like fill in that space, but also to say, hey, we're here too, and we all have our stuff, and we all have our own personal traumas and our own silences, and
we have a part in this too.
Yeah, we do, and we're here now, and we miss you, and we're sad, and we're trying to figure it out.
So I asked Diana to read the first poem that's built around her brother's body, the family formed around what's cut out. There are two realities there, hers and her brother's. You'll hear in the reading where those two collide.
So I'm going to read the first triptych, and it begins with the first image. It's a little blurry of four individuals dressed for a wedding. You see a house with windows and some trees, and the girls are wearing white gloves, because my mother thought that gloves were very ladylike. And there's a shard in the shape of, it almost looks like a child-sized coffin, and then that's where my brother cut himself out. So I'm the eldest, and then I have a sister who's 2 years younger, and then my brother was 5 years younger than me, so he was the youngest child. My father's in a tie. So the first part that I'll read will be words in the shape of that shard, and then I'll pause, and then I'll read the part of the poem, which is the photograph around the white space. And you'll hear orally where the cuts are in the words, where they are visually on the page. Triptych. Mindful of the setting, he counted off the seconds in his head as the solitary bee struggles to fly inside the walls of an empty house. Her sisters dead below her. No wind, no rain. We stayed. Framing, an act of enclosing, of closing off yourself from your environment and all the unintended sounds, car stereos, solitary bird in the tree, the male mouse alone in his cell who detects the trace of a female, pattering rain, neighbors upstairs spilling rice across the floors and slipping constantly, the drone of a sister bee's in the walls of your room lost for weeks, months, and each afternoon you wake to find a new bee on your windowsill, all wings still, and all the days unfold like this. Until you are not at the window, but the dead bees continue to come still, coming to a moment of our attention, framing, to get lost between the walls and open the mind to music. One must remove oneself, or framing will remove you. You could not remove the bee that kept reappearing. The sisters were unending. You could not remove the drone, the hum inside your mind. You removed your mind. Open the mind. All sounds are music. I am listening to a needle drop. 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 I am listening to. I am dropping all the needles. I keep on dropping the needles. I have always dropped needles. The needles are stacked in my palm, in the palm of my hand, of my mind, my hands and O's, the environment of the needles. What can you hear in the amplified cactus of this palm of mine? Pay attention. Each time the thrums of a dishwasher are different. Let me not be the only listener, wishing that the music could go on a little longer. Unintended sounds and all. Let me not this stupid amplified cactus begging for some new approach to framing, to listening, to unattended. I will attend to you listening in a moment of attention to life. My mind is open to the fact. Let me beg. Let me blur these boundaries between life and soundlessness. I will do all the exercises. I will listen to all that drops. Please be not art, but life. Be life. Please be here. A simple explanation for resistance. Our human ears have vulnerability to unfamiliar sounds. When you hear these sounds and feel trapped, you must remove yourself from what surrounds you. These sounds, we have vulnerability to unfamiliar. Remove yourself from frames. Remove the frame. Remove the do not panic. Do not panic is the simplest explanation, the simplest resistance to music. Do not simply resist. resist. We who are free to move around, who are free, bewilder. We bewilder what we fill in. What bewilders us to fill in what?
Something I got listening to you, and this may be nothing you intended, but just hearing you, you know, I told you before we opened the microphones that my brother killed himself about 6 years ago, and I heard when I heard you reading and then being stopped, and it reminded me of my family and me kind of wanting to go on, and then we can't. You know, we want to go forward and it's out of our control. You know, we keep being stopped. We keep stuttering.
Yes.
And it's that void that's always going to be there.
Yeah. And you learn to accommodate it into your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's taken me time to do that. Mm. It's such a visceral experience too, right? Like in real life, but then also writing that poem and then reading that poem. Like I have to, my body, I think you it's like you're running and then you have to stop.
Yeah.
And you still have that momentum in your body.
Yeah.
So it reverberates and then you start again. And there's a kind of adrenaline that happens within that.
That was poet Diana Coy Wynn, who talked with me last week about her new book, Ghost Of. You know, she told me that the Vietnamese language doesn't have a subjunctive mood, which is the mood that expresses regret. Both the language and her family tend to try to look forward. In her work, Diana tries to maintain a view of the past so that it doesn't get lost.